down here, fallout shelter, paint my walls twice a week. Sitting down here, fallout shelter, think about the slave long time ago.
Hello and welcome to Weekly Monotony, the official podcast of the entertainment blog DailyMonotony.com, where we can talk about any topic we want, anytime. Other blogs got to talk about everything, all the time. I'm, of course, Dustin Anglin.
And I'm Scott John Scott, reminding you that John Dillinger has given us a second chance to review the movie about John Dillinger.
And I am Todd Anglin, special guest once again, crashing the party, and I have no catchy catchphrase, so let's just move past me.
Epic fail. All right.
I'll prepare one next time, apparently.
So, of course, we are talking about Public Enemies, Michael Mann's new film, which came out last week. But before we get into that review, as always, we're going to talk a little bit about what we've been watching and what we've been playing and maybe a little bit of news items that were interesting from the past week. So first of all, I'll throw things over to Scott. What have you been playing, watching, anything cool you want to talk about?
Well, not really playing that much. Well, actually a little bit of Halo 2 on the original Xbox, grinding through the back ends of the code and picking up skulls, but you know how that goes.
That's always fun.
At least the original Xbox still works.
Yeah, true. If you haven't converted into a space heater or a doorstop yet, it still serves up some very old-looking games with lots of texture pop.
But Jay Allard would be proud.
I'm sure it would. What I've been watching, well, it's been sort of an eventful week. Somebody signed up for Netflix, and the rest of the story
goes
there. So I started out with Robert Zemeckis' Contact, 1997.
Oh.
Some classic, or supposedly classic sci-fi that I hadn't seen.
Now, are you doing this, the Blu-ray option, or just going normal DVD route?
I'm going the Blu-ray option.
Ah, well, quite
so
nice.
It's all HD all the time, except for movies which aren't available in HD, like Contact.
was not available in HD?
Correct.
Oh, that's unfortunate. Well,
is unfortunate, It does have some visualness. I'm supposed to like it because, you know, it's Carl Sagan who wrote the novel that it's based on and all that, and it's supposed to be magical, but really I didn't swallow very much of it. The first act I thought was sort of unpalpable, and then from there on out it was just like, hey, look, it's the Very Large Array, also featured in Terminator Salvation, every other movie that needs a satellite dish.
they also showed the...
I wanted more aliens in my alien movie.
That was the biggest complaint, I think, about that movie, is that you really don't get to see aliens except for the shadowy image of Jodie Foster's father. But Contact is an interesting movie. It's often touted as one of the better science fiction movies of the late 20th century, and I'll have to admit, the first time I saw it, I was sort of in the camp of everyone else, of like, don't quite buy it, a little stupid, but the more times I've seen it, I do enjoy it for the ironic nature of what it's saying and who basically wrote the story, because Carl Sagan, of course, is a very famous atheist, and has been one of the most pronounced atheists of our time, leading that movement, I guess. And the movie really, or at least the story Contact, is less about science fiction and more about faith in the end. And
science faith.
And what it means, I mean, not necessarily science faith, but I mean just faith in general. And of course, you know, a huge dose of Sagan dumped into it. But it's an interesting concept of, you know, a hardcore atheist really talking about the concepts of what it means to have faith in anything. And so I've enjoyed it just for that kind of contradictory nature of the writer and the way the sort of story and the thing he's trying to get across in the movie. But beyond that, it's also, I think, one of the more visually striking movies of that era, the kind of late 90s era of computer graphics. Definitely just a fun story, if nothing else. Todd, do you remember... Contact, the Zemeckis movie?
Yeah, I remember it. Just not a fan. I think I still fall into the camp of, you know, I mean, Jodie Foster for me in the role. I'm not a huge Jodie Foster fan to begin with, so it sort of works against my liking of the movie. But I don't know. For me, I don't know if I can just can't shake her from other movies I've seen her in, but just not a fan. And the space shuttle being a big sphere, I mean, I don't know. It just was just sort of anticlimactic for me. I don't remember the – I don't really – since it's about, what, 10 years ago now, I don't remember the full details of my experience. I don't think I've watched it since then, but I remember it not being one of my favorite movies at the time.
Yeah.
Maybe I should go rewatch it. Maybe that's my goal here now.
Maybe that's you. I would actually – I would recommend this movie for anyone who's looking for a good sci-fi movie. I actually have found it more enjoyable later on, sort of looking into it in retrospect, but –
I mean, I obviously like the director. The director makes movies that I like a lot.
Yeah,
so
sure,
there should be something going for it.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a top-notch Zemeckis stuff, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe toppest notch.
Toppest notch, wow.
So what else have you been watching from your Netflix queue?
So then I was prepping myself for Synecdoche.
Oh.
And decided I'd better flesh out some more Charlie Kaufman material. So I picked up the Charlie Kaufman written, Michael Gondry directed Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, 2004.
Yes, with...
which I hadn't seen previously.
Kate Winslet and...
Mr. Carey.
Jim Carrey, yeah.
Yes, and a bunch of other random people like Elijah Wood and Kirsten Dunst and those sorts of people. Oh, and a great, great, great role by Tom Wilkinson,
Tom
as usual.
Wilkinson.
Like anything that if he opens his mouth, I'd like the role, so...
I am Shiva, the god of death.
Yeah. Let's get out of Milwaukee now.
Cool. So what did you think of Eternal Sunshine of a Spotless Mind?
I liked... You know, it's the sort of movie that I feel like I need to watch a few more times and digest pretty thoroughly. I guess it deserves the Oscar it won for original screenplay because it's a pretty genius idea that gets booped out. It was... somewhat difficult to follow, but a lot of parts of it were very striking, and I think by the end it all sort of gelled together in my mind.
Right.
And I appreciated it quite a bit at that point. I think a really intriguing sort of thing to stretch your mind out and try to get you to think outside of the cinematic box. Not just overly laden with sub-cinema, but I guess the presentation is what's more intriguing necessarily than the story itself.
Sure. No, I actually...
Sort of like Memento.
It is kind of a Memento concept. In fact, a very similar concept. But I do really like that film. That's, I think, probably one of my favorite Charlie Kaufman written works, I guess. I think the reason I like it is it actually feels far more approachable than other Charlie Kaufman stuff. Like, you know, I assume Synecdoche will be coming in. As you see that, the approachability of Synecdoche is almost, you know, like... English scholar, like PhD student level, whereas I felt like Eternal Sunshine of a Spotless Mind is something that just about anyone could maybe understand toward the end. And beyond it being so, you know, solely cerebral, I think when they sort of get into this, the later concepts, so they're actually trying to visualize some of the things that are going on without giving away too much spoilers, I think they do a good job of it, and it's actually really an interesting way of kind of going through this concept. But, yeah, definitely. I think it's a great movie. Todd, I imagine you probably have not seen this movie. It's a
now. Why would you say that?
It's
true, but why would you say it?
Well, this is an independent film. Like this is the kind of movie that I would have never heard of had I not, you know, started getting deeper into movie blogs and movie podcasts in general. And this is kind of one of the first films you start to hear about a lot when you sort of dig a little bit deeper into the cinema culture. And something that, you know, I'd like, this probably didn't play in theaters, probably had a limited release, but
it was a Focus Features sort of indie art house.
But I think it's a legitimately really good movie with a lot of well-known actors in it. I think
Eternal
this is
Sunshine.
Yeah, I think this is something that you and Raimi might actually even enjoy.
Well,
so.
it got a lot of marketing push when it was released. I remember this being all over the TV and being promoted. So this movie, even if it feels independent, it got a lot of mainstream promotion. I just never saw it. So,
true.
I mean, I have a hard time leading behind the Jim Carrey of Dumb and Dumber days to embrace him as Jim Carrey of
this,
dramatic actor.
I think this
days.
Is the best role I've seen Jim Carrey in since The Truman Show. And I actually really enjoyed this Truman Show performance. So,
Yeah, no, I enjoyed Truman Show as well, despite I don't think it got really great critical press, but I enjoyed Truman Show and Jim Carrey's personality there. So I do like Jim Carrey typically as an actor, and I may have just missed that one, so I'll add that right behind Contact, and I'll just start lining these up.
Sounds like a good list going already. Cool.
Well, on this,
it'll
on
only
the
take
side.
Me a couple years to watch those.
Interestingly enough, I know the Truman Show wasn't necessarily a favorite of critics, but it's actually a favorite of modern continental philosophers as a
Whoa.
Sort of cultural distillation of what's the sort of post-Lacanian, technically Zizekian philosophy, just so you know.
Now we need to condense that into English for the rest of us.
So basically, philosophy in Europe after Freud equals the Truman Show.
Sure.
Sounds about right.
For me?
Just so you know.
Freudian, I understand Truman Show. We're good.
We're good. Okay. Cool. Moving on. Todd, I know you have some news to talk about, but before we get to that, I'll talk a bit about some of the things I've been watching so we can transition into news. So this week, besides Public Enemies, I went and caught a movie I've been so freakishly excited to see ever since I
freakishly excited.
Ever since I saw the first trailer for this movie, I've been incredibly excited to see it. And this movie is Duncan Jones' Moon. It's a science fiction story starring Sam Rockwell and Kevin Spacey as the voice of this almost HAL robot character.
That's
but
fun.
The reason why I was excited about this is it's an independent science fiction film, but this movie looked the most like a sort of follow-up to kind of Sunshine or other independent science fiction films of the past. And I'm a sucker for science fiction as a genre, especially when it comes to independent science fiction movies. And so finally got a chance. They finally put in a theater nearby. I actually like ran for 30 minutes up a hill to get to this theater on time to see it. The brief story is basically it's almost a lone acting piece by Sam Rockwell, who is this miner on the moon, not miner like under 21, but miner as
hey, you got some cigarettes? Buy me some Martian booze.
But miner as someone who's there on this facility that is mining, I think, helium-3 to produce for fission plants, which are producing free and clean energy back on Earth. And it's basically it's an automated facility, but they need one person there to watch it in case anything goes wrong and to go collect the little tubes of helium-3 when they're done and send it back to Earth. And it's what I really love about this movie is, like all science fiction movies, there's some, you know, weird twist in there, some kind of cerebral mind-bending twist in it. But the thing about this is, rather than drawing out what that twist is like over the course of the movie and then kind of hitting you with it at the end and kind of giving you that kind of startled, oh my goodness thing and kind of leaving you there, they very slowly ease you into it. And by about 20 or 30 minutes into this movie, you know what the twist is. In fact, they even confirm it for you. They actually speak it out and like, this is the twist, now you know. And they spend the rest of that time just letting you like comprehend what that means, and then letting Sam Rockwell give this amazing performance based on what that concept is. And I don't want to say it because I think it's fun for people to sort of figure out what it is as they watch the movie. But it really just becomes this powerhouse character piece by Sam Rockwell, and I think if they do not give him some sort of nomination for this performance, then if someone needs to, like, the Academy Awards.
The movie is called Moon. Not Duncan Moon, because I just had a really hard time finding this on.
Just yeah,
IMDb,
just
but
just
directed by Duncan Jones.
Directed by Duncan Jones, who's actually the son of James or David Bowie, the English rocker, and
sure.
I think he's actually going under a pseudonym as Duncan Jones because he didn't want to ride the coattails of the Bowie name. So. But yeah, just a phenomenal film. It's a smart science fiction movie, but it's not so crazy that they try to like leave you behind. Like the fact that they do tell you what the twist is sort of 30 minutes into the movie is, I think, kind of telling of how this movie is. It's like they really don't want to leave you thinking about crazy situations. They want you to appreciate the situation and appreciate the character, and they almost, even getting up to the reveal, they they do it in a way that almost like slowly hints you at what's going on, so that about 5 minutes before they actually like tell you what the reveal is, you figured it out yourself, and so you feel kind of smart too, which is another just a great way that this story is told.
Always helps to feel smart.
It does, right? Like you, it's like when you read a good mystery novel, you want to just figure out what's about to happen right before they tell you, and that makes you feel clever and smart. And this movie does it in a way that I think is just phenomenally done. So if you can see it, and this is super super limited release, like it took me forever to find this film, but hopefully
you're basically saying none of us can see it now that you've given a great review.
I mean, hopefully it'll get some more traction and it'll become wider a bit later on, and though it's probably only going to be in your theater for like a week or two just because it's such a small thing, but if you see Moon appear in your local theater, rush out and see it. I think this is the best science fiction film of this year so far, and I would put that over Star Trek, though Star Trek is kind of in a different category.
Wow, that's pretty big.
Well, Star Trek is in a different category, so I don't want to blanket say that they're similar films, but
then don't.
Then I won't. But either way,
pretty rushed there.
Either way, Moon, great film. Go see it. That's what I was watching. That's basically all I have to talk about there. So Todd, why don't you go ahead and tell us some of the cool news things that you wanted to talk about?
Sure. So segue, movies behind gaming news. For those of you out there gaming, I'm not, but I'm paying attention to news. I wish
Being
I had
about
time.
Others who are playing games.
I'm looking at those who have time to play and wishing I was there with the time. I really do. But life is busy in Telluric Land. One of the things I jotted a few notes down as I generally follow Joystick most often. It's a great gaming blog. It condenses things well. It's not long-winded like us. If you're looking for a great place to keep up with gaming news, good place to go.
The opinions of Todd England do not reflect the opinions of DavidMotley.com.
Hey, come on now. So one of the things that I jotted down is that StarCraft II, I'm sure you guys are familiar. We all played StarCraft back in the day. We remember the modem games.
Oh, yes.
But one of the things recently revealed, and there's a whole wave of StarCraft II news, it seems like, in the last week or so, is that StarCraft II will not have LAN game support. LAN, LAN game support, for those of you not familiar with the term. I don't know. The reason I wanted to write this down and bring it up is I don't know how big of a deal this is. Because if you remember, back in the day, this LAN game support, while all of us loners who sit at home and play games people across the globe, not a big deal. But LAN game support is what enables these sort of pseudo LAN parties, that kind of goes in the name, or these little companies that have set up shop, and perhaps you've seen them in your local strip malls, where
Internet
they
cafes,
put a bunch of computers in a room, they install a game, and you can come in and play against all the people in that room. It requires human contact. I know this may be a foreign concept for some people. But what do you guys think about that? I was a little surprised that they chose to pull LAN support, and when I read more about why they decided to do this, it was pretty clear why they did. They said, oh, you know, in typical marketing speak, oh, we've got this great service that, you know, enables, you know, a very powerful matchmaking experience online.
Right.
Oh, and by the way, it has punk busting services to avoid piracy. So essentially the end result here is that piracy killed the LAN game. Is this a big deal in 2009, or is LAN game kind of already a dead thing?
Well, that's first of all, it's really ironic because the original version of StarCraft, you could actually take it. You can install what was called It was like a spawn copy or something on another person's computer, and it didn't have the full version of the game, but the only thing this thing allowed you to do was play local LAN games with it. And it was that was a feature of the game, of the disc that Blizzard made. So that,
funny what 10 years does.
That's actually really baffling, that because you would imagine if you support a game over, you know, TCP/IP, then why not over local stuff that doesn't go through a central server? The only thing I can think of is that they want to host all the servers that play stuff so they can guarantee basically good performance when people play stuff.
Blizzard's official statement, essentially, if you peel back the marketing speak, is that they want to be able to validate that every game playing in an online game is properly licensed. So this is all about piracy for them. This is about making sure that you didn't buy one copy installed on 20 computers, disconnect them from the internet, and then just play LAN games all night long. They want to make sure every time you use the game in online mode, you're going through their piracy checking servers.
Interesting.
And so it seems like this whole move is just a piracy move, and I'm surprised that they do this. I would think that the core gamer audience might be a little upset by this.
Yeah, I thought Blizzard in general was not as big on the anti-piracy bent because they just wanted to get you hooked into it so you could eventually, you know, get WoW or something
eventually
like that.
Eventually play WoW.
Yeah. Yeah. No,
everything leads to WoW.
I don't know if we've gone past the era where we need a LAN connection, because I mean everyone is connected to the internet all the time now, and it's not like you need to be connected by a wire anymore, which is why, you know, the purpose of, you know, doing a LAN party with someone else is, you know, you couldn't all jack into their actual internet through the Ethernet ports. But yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
It seems bizarre. Like, I don't feel like we've gone so past doing like local games that you should just not support it.
Sure.
But yeah, all I can say is that that's going to be like the first, you know, patch hack that's released by someone is local support for StarCraft 2.
Right. So that was my first bit of news. I don't know if there's more comments on that, but if there's not, let me introduce my second piece of gaming news. Last week, you may have recalled when I joined you guys for this fun talking fest that there was some news about Reach and what Reach's sort of positioning was in the launch of Microsoft's upcoming Project Natal, or their motion capture input device. This week, more news comes out, this time not exactly from Microsoft, but from a separate PhD research guy doing research on gaming input. And he basically is showing demos of FPS, or first-person shooter, head tracking. And so basically what he's done is he's taken Half-Life 2's Source engine and he's used a very basic camera and done some proof-of-concept stuff, similar to what Johnny Lee, the guy now working at Microsoft on Project Natal, did with the Wii, but shown how you can use a standard input control like a controller in combination with head tracking to do things like peering around corners or adjusting the look around different objects in the games, kind of like we talked about last week. So it's very relevant to our discussion then. It seems like there's already proof of concept stuff out there, and it sounds like people are already starting to draw lines between these proof of concept things that are on the web to Project Natal, and then by virtue from that to Halo Reach. So how do you guys feel about that? With this sort of new proof of concept stuff, does this do anything else to sort of shape your opinion of how Natal could be integrated with the upcoming Halo Reach franchise?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is just, I mean, this is all, I think, pointing, and I wonder if this is an all calculated, you know, little drips of tantalizing information being
marketing
pushed
at its best.
Yeah, being pushed through the Microsoft marketing group. But no, that's just great to hear, and I'm glad to hear that they're thinking about doing it in a way that's, you know, head tracking and not necessarily, you know, hand waving. So
look over here, I'm doing something.
Yeah. I think that's actually really cool.
I think it's cool. I mean, I don't know exactly, I'm going to be completely honest, I don't know if it's going to feel natural, because, you know, we all recline back, you know, we're playing our video games.
How much do you move your head?
If we're under 21, we're doing it with our Cokes. If we're 21, we're doing it for prison margaritas. Either way, we're reclining and enjoying a game, and so if I have to keep my body in a certain position to enjoy the game, I'm not sure if that's going to really translate well when it comes down to it, but
sure.
I'm interested in it. It makes me very curious to see it in action, and I'm really hoping that whether it's Halo Reach or some other game in that Natal time frame, that we do see something that tries to be very subtle with the use of the new technology and not really overt, where we do have to flail our arms to make something happen. So
right.
More news out there. I think there's a video out there showing this demo, so if people want to check it out, I think they can probably Google head tracking and joystick and find it. But something I throw out there for gamers interested in what's happening with Natal.
That's as always, great information to hear. And now we can always only hope the best for what they do, and they will do something smart and not something, you know, Wii Sports-y.
In fact, speaking of Wii Sports, I saw a news item today that the E3 2008 Wii Sports Resorts demo that they showed last year at E3 had only been in development for something like 3 months. It was either 3 weeks or 3 months. I'm going to say 3 months because that sounds more reasonable speaking as a developer before the actual E3 demos. And so those three demos we saw in E3 2008 of, I think it was like, three different, obviously three demos, three sports,
like,
whatever the
sports
were.
I think it was like the wave race game, the sword game, and something else.
Yeah, it was three very basic games. Those were the only things that existed at that time. And so basically according to the news we saw today, they only thought of the sequel 3 months ahead of E3, whipped something together, put it out there, and then it sounds like for the rest of the time since then, that development team has basically been scrambling to add the features to the game
that they promised.
That their executives keep promising in the press. So like, they'll have the executive go out and say, oh, yes, there'll be golf in Wii Sports Resorts.
Crap,
oh, crap, we got
to
go build
golf again?
So that game sounds like it's a very agile, iterative process for you developers.
That's kind of interesting. Well, I've heard good things about both the Motion Plus and Wii Sports Resort. So apparently a lot of people have been saying that whereas Wii Sports, the original, felt like a tech demo, this feels a bit more like a full-fledged game. So more content and much less of the thing you kind of show off to your friends when you want to show them the cool new Wii.
Yeah. Well, I enjoyed Wii Sports, so I mean, if they can do something that captures that same essence but then builds more game on top of it, I'm all for that.
Yeah, so definitely something to pick up, and of course they're selling it the same way they sold Wii Sports, which is bundling it with a peripheral or with a device, and so this will actually come with a new Wii Motion Sensor Plus. So,
How about that?
So I mean, it really is a bargain to pick it up because you pay the same price as a normal game and you get basically the new, like, the Rumble Pack for the...
That's right, the Rumble Pack, N64 days.
Yep, yeah. Yep, so, no, that's kind of the Nintendo model. I remember picking up the Rumble Pack with Star Fox and the graphics accelerator chip with Rogue Squadron, which basically added, I think, like, 4 megabytes more of video memory.
To the N64?
Yep, for the N64.
Do you remember that? There's a game even for the Super Nintendo. I think it was like some sort of pseudo 3D car crashing game.
Stunt Racer FX.
Yeah, Stunt Racer, yeah. And it had like an extra 3D processor chip on the Super Nintendo game.
That's back when the game itself was a stick of memory, and they had a 32-bit processor. everything else was 16-bit memory locations, and that game had 32 bits, and so they could do really... really low frame
really
rate,
cool
crappy
3D.
crappy 3D stuff.
I remember the horns with little cars. Every car had the same horn, including the Big Mac truck. Okay, that's all the gaming news I have, though.
Good old days. All right, well, I think that's about all we have to talk about. So let's jump into our review of Michael Mann's Public Enemies.
Hit the road, sport. Keep the tip. You ain't getting other people's hats and coats no more, neither.
Why'd you do that?
Because you're with me now.
I don't know anything about you.
I was raised on a farm in Mooresville, Indiana. My mama died when I was 3. My daddy beat the hell out of me because he didn't know no better way to raise me. I like baseball, movies, good clothes, fast cars, whiskey, and you. What else you need to know?
Alrighty. Michael Mann's Public Enemies, starring Johnny Depp, Christian Bale, Marion Cotillard, and Billy Crudup. Scott, what did you think of Michael Mann's latest feature on digital video?
I think we all need 1934 accents.
Or at least Billy Crudup J. Edgar Hoover accents.
Yes. I mean, and speaking of accents, how about that accent that Christian Bale was sporting this time? Truly weird, huh?
It did not strike me as something memorable. It was just kind of like a
reminds
southern...
me of every other movie he does where he actually talks. It's like Batman, like 310 to Yuma.
It was very 310 to Yuma. I think that's the best correlation.
Where's John Dillinger?
Right.
So accents,
right. I mean, you know, this is the sort of movie where you talk about the accents and maybe you move up to the technical details, and at the end you're like, oh, I guess there was a story. Yeah, I don't really remember that part.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
But I mean, yeah. So Public Enemies, obviously, it's not a heist movie. It's not a caper or con movie, which you might think watching the trailer. You might think it's about robbing banks. It's not about robbing banks. It's about a badass who keeps getting arrested because you're too complacent with yourself and attempting to be cool while being caught. Plus a random shootout where you can't understand who's shooting at who because everyone wears trench coats and these cool hats.
Good point.
So ultimately, I mean, in this, you know, the performances are good. The writing's fairly sharp. It just is sort of missing any sort of human touch. You know, the characterizations, I mean, it doesn't seem like there's anything wrong with what they do, but they never really flesh out. You never get the sense of characters, even for the main character. He's always feels sort of like he's at a screenplay's distance from you. And then as far as the technical aspects of this film is concerned, ironically, my nearby all-digital theater went film.
Huh. What?
For reasons I don't understand. So I actually screened this on a celluloid copy, though it was the second night it had been showing, so it was very clean and in focus.
Weird.
Same.
It was really hard for me to judge just how looking it was, because there was presentation grain because of the way it was screened for me. But it did look a little funky, especially the dark scenes felt a little handycam.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely noticed the almost the frame rate quality. It's almost like the 120 hertz things you see on television, where it does look a little handycam or a little bit. I think I heard someone say this, like it looks a little bit like the behind the scenes of the action scene shot in a film movie.
It's like it should end up on the DVD, not in the movie.
Right. Okay. Well, interesting. Todd, what are your thoughts?
So to be fair, I saw this movie mere hours ago, so my thoughts are fresh.
Okay.
I haven't had a lot of time for this to soak in, but I do have some fair opinions on this. I think Scott actually hit a few things on the head, and I'll phrase them a bit differently, but I think they're the same points. And essentially, one of the things he mentioned is that the characters feel very flat. And the flat characters don't allow you to get a lot of emotional connection to the story. And I think that's really true. For as much story as there is in this movie, and it progresses through a lot of story, and we'll touch on maybe that more later, you don't ever really get really emotionally connected. And I think that's sort of what Scott was touching on, is that you just don't feel that story come through, even for Johnny Depp, who plays the main character in this movie. So it's a little unfortunate, because I think this movie really, really wanted you to get attached to the characters, and there are a few points in it we can talk about later that definitely make you feel that they're almost saying, please be attached to this character. But I didn't really get that connection either. I was never really emotionally moved in this movie the way I was, let's say, in Up. And anybody who's not seen Up from Pixar, go watch that. Go see how you're moved emotionally there, and then watch Public Enemies, and you'll recognize there's just a different level of emotional connection to the characters in this movie. So I think that's right on the money. I will also say, I'll leave the technical stuff to later, because I do agree that some of the handycam stuff is, it just didn't work for me, but I know that's something of Michael Mann's signature, but I'd prefer not to introduce that at this point. We can chat that later. In terms of the actual movie and the story, my base or my bottom line response to this movie is that it was an interesting story. I thought Johnny Depp did an exceptional job playing this role. I really didn't expect him to do any less, but I thought the movie was just longer than it needed to be. I felt like this is a movie where, for me, watching it, I felt the directors knew they only could make one movie. This is one of those kind of movies where you just can't make a sequel, and they just couldn't leave anything on the cutting room floor. So they kept putting scene in after scene that really you could have done without.
Sure.
And they started sacrificing the entertainment value for this movie in favor of the let's get everything we can to make it feel very complete or historically accurate or whatever. I'm not sure what their motivation was. But the movie did end up feeling a little bit longer than it needs to be entertaining. But that said, good story, in my opinion, overdone. Put a bottom line on it.
Huh. Well, I think I maybe enjoyed this film a little bit more than both of you guys did, but I think I agree in general with a lot of the concepts you have. The way this film... So, I mean, this is a... It's a film that you might think going into it is going to be a biopic about John Dillinger, the very, very famous bank robber from the 1920s. Or 1930s.
30s.
Yeah. And... But it's really not. It's like it really is a sort of long narrative about John Dillinger and what's the name of that the guy that Christian Bale plays?
Purvis. Agent Purvis.
Yeah, basically this FBI agent who is trying to track him down, and is sort of brought up as two Titan characters in their own world, slowly waiting to come together and kind of, you know, meet at the end in some kind of final showdown. But you really don't get to know either character very well during the entire movie. Though, I mean, on that level, I felt like there are a lot of things that combined into this movie to make it feel a bit more like they're trying to almost shoot it in a documentary style. And the fact that you don't get into the intricacies and the sort of the depths of the individual characters' heads almost reaffirmed some of that documentary style to me. The fact that you really are seeing things from sort of over the shoulder, the fly on the wall point of view of what these characters are doing. And for a character like John Dillinger, who was basically, you know, a carefree bank robber, a kind of rebel without a cause sort of character, you got the feeling that he really did, I guess, hold a lot of his inner and deeper things inside. And I feel like Johnny Depp's really got that across, and he almost kind of reminded me of you know, like what, like our grandfather the concept of, you know, that generation, the sort of World War II generation, and the way that men didn't wear their hearts on their sleeves. They kept everything very close in. And maybe that's why they didn't feel as, I don't know, gushing of emotion as we would expect from, I guess, modern actors or modern portrayals of actors. And so that way, I think I maybe liked it because it really tuned me into the era and the genre of the entire piece. And even though I felt like the first 20 minutes of this movie were almost really boring, like the first couple bank robberies are almost like annoyingly boring. It's like, you're robbing a bank? Shouldn't this be exciting? I felt like by the end, when they sort of when they mixed the sort of the tenseness of basically John Dillinger's fall from glory and him being slowly hunted down by the FBI, I actually really got behind at least the excitement of that story. And by the end, I left the movie really enjoying it. So overall, I actually thought this was a pretty good movie. Though again, it's almost in that gray area. But it's kind of hard to define why I liked it, and it's definitely not something I ran out gushing about.
So, building on what you said there, you actually had a couple of points that I think you agreed with what Scott and I were saying, but you sort of twisted it in a way, not necessarily twisting in a bad way, but to a different perspective.
Sure.
And that it does come across for a number of reasons as feeling a bit more documentary than it does entertaining film. Part of it's the way it's shot, I think. Part of it is the way the script is written, as you mentioned, the way their emotions are portrayed.
Right.
But for me, and again, I went to this with my wife, so it was a date movie, so there's that sort of date perspective on this, and it was definitely a watcher. For those of you who do look for what date movie is a good movie, expect your wife to watch their watch on this one. I don't know. I mean, it was definitely – I wish they would have made it more entertaining, maybe taken more artistic liberty.
Sure.
Portrayed the film a little less documentary, but I think that would have, for me at least, would have helped move the movie along a little bit faster.
No, I agree. Like, you definitely can't call this like an intense action film, although there are some intense action sequences, and I did feel the thrill of those sequences, though they are spread out by kind of big lulls in the plot and story as they kind of move things on, and I guess maybe an overly long exposition about the character.
Yeah, yeah. Spread out, not only spread out, but even drawn out. So even though we spread out the action scenes themselves seem to take a long time to really wrap up. And that in itself sometimes makes you feel like the action is not quite as intense as perhaps it is on screen. So I don't know. Overall, I come back to this point that it just seems like they couldn't take the knife to the film and
right.
leave things on the editing room floor that they could have.
Sure. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the action sequences in this. One of the things I thought, you know, as this movie started off, you know, there's a lot of gunfights outside of banks, but I actually think, you know, one of the big action sequences is later on when there's basically this shootout between FBI and John Dillinger and I think like Babyface Nelson and some other guys in this cabin in the woods at night. And I actually found that shootout to be really interesting, even though it is one of the more long drawn out sequences, just because I think there was something about the way the digital camera that this movie was shot on was showing that sequence at night, making it look even more documentary style, more like History Channel reenactment style, I guess. That I think really sold almost the realism of that moment to me. And like I think one of the few facts, like Johnny Depp's character picks up a gun and just like shoots out the window, and we see that all in this documentary style, I almost felt like, man, they must be shooting like real bullets, because that looks exactly like the way you'd expect a gun like that to like shoot out this window and shoot through these sort of, you know, 1930s wooden cabin walls. And I actually really enjoyed that. I found that to be one of the most realistic gunfights I've seen in a long time.
I'll throw in a dissenting opinion on that. For me, it was just a bunch of guys in trench coats in the dark. Everyone has a Thompson submachine gun, and it's very hard to tell who's shooting at who, and when somebody gets hit, what's happening. And I thought it lasted too long. I mean, for me, it's like, how long can you shoot at people in a wood cabin before they get hit? I mean, it is a wood cabin, and those are 45 ACP rounds.
Yeah, but I mean, to be fair,
yeah,
like,
I've got to agree with Scott here. I mean, I think that for me, I felt the exact same thing. This is almost the same criticism I had of Transformers, is that there was not enough visual differentiation between the people fighting on screen, to the point that in that scene you're referring to, there's a point at which the FBI totally guns down some of the bad guys. I thought that they'd actually gunned down Johnny Depp at that point. I thought they'd gunned down John Dillinger. I was like, oh,
well, that's, I mean,
the end of the movie. But that, it had already been quite a long point to get to that
to be
point.
Fair, that's,
sure enough, it was that a new character.
I mean, that was part of that whole sequence, is that they were rushing in the dark, unprepared, and they couldn't tell who they were shooting at, and that was part of the problem of it, and why they were basically...
Neither could we as the audience, so isn't that a bit of a problem?
No, I think, to me, that reinforced the FBI's sort of issue of this, that we're going into this, like, that the old guy who was sort of like the advisor for Christian Bale's character is like, you know, this is not the way that we should do this. This is a bad idea. They go into it, and it really does turn into sort of a big snafu, because it's in the dark. They can't tell who they're shooting at. They shoot up these people in a car. They think they may have gotten John Dillinger. They see someone running off. They think maybe that's John Dillinger, and it sort of spreads them out, and more people end up dying because of that. And to me, that reinforced sort of the concept of what you're trying to get across in both the people's heads, both the Johnny Depp character who's kind of running around in the dark in the woods in this sort of chaotic situation, and the FBI people who are desperately trying to get this person they've been going after and failing at it just because of the environment. So maybe I appreciate it from the storytelling or the historical, like, truthfulness,
yeah,
of it.
What is this? Is this a documentary or is this a movie, for goodness sake?
I mean,
but it should be entertaining at some point, not just like, oh, I can see this on the History Channel.
Sure, but
in the movie theater.
I guess to me, showing that helps me get like into the mindset of the characters, and that's what this movie was trying to get across. Like, it wasn't trying to be a popcorn action flick. It was trying to get you into the mind of these two different characters, both sort of coming to a head, and to me that really helped sell it. But I can see why people, you know, going into this expecting a sort of
a movie
or expecting a Scorsese kind of movie, right? So, which is, you know, a movie about gangsters, you know, very romanticized. Like, that's definitely not what Michael Mann's style is, and I think that's where a lot of people are going to be disappointed by this film.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to dominate here, but I think that for me, Michael Mann is a little confused about whether he's making documentaries for the History Channel or whether he's making entertaining movies for the theater. I'm right there with you. I actually understand intellectually what you're saying. I also understood that whole cabin scene you're describing. I felt that sort of that fret that the Purvis character felt, or that the Christian Bale character felt about losing his man and rushing into things and realizing he'd made a bad decision. I really got all that. But while I understood it intellectually, I wasn't entertained by what I was being shown on screen. In fact, I could have been shown a lot less and still gotten that same feeling from the movie. So for me, once again, it was just a matter of, okay, I get it already. You know, you don't have to spell it out in such excruciating detail that I understand the documentary you're trying to paint. And so it's sort of one of those things. It's like there's doing it and there's overdoing. I thought in a number of cases, including the scene you're describing, this movie just tended to overdo it a bit and lose its entertainment value for that reason.
I think that's definitely fair that this movie was not cut like an action film. It was very much cut like a drama, a long sort of long drawn out sequences, even when showing action. And I guess it's misleading in some ways, and it's definitely not as exciting and as entertaining. And I totally appreciate the perspective you're coming from. So I think we'll just have to agree to disagree, or at least agree that this is going to hit people in different ways. Like if you're more of a history nut, kind of like I am, you may enjoy it from that perspective. If you're looking for just, you know, raw entertainment, definitely these sequences are not as entertaining as other action films, other action sequences are.
Or other dramas are. I mean, the point of this film is to create this character profile, these vignettes of these two characters, the good guy and the bad guy, but I just don't think it succeeds very well at doing that.
Yeah.
I'll agree to like the point, like especially at the end of this movie where they sort of talk about what the characters kind of went on to do, like what happened to people, like sort of I guess Animal House like moments where like, and this is what people did when they grew up. Like one of the things they talk about, the Christian Bale character, Melvin Purvis, like they throw that out there and you're kind of like, what? it's like, how would we have known that was coming? Like, I don't think we got deep enough into this guy's psyche to understand what happened to him later. So yeah. In that degree, they don't develop the characters as much, and maybe there is too much reliance on the very lengthy plot and not the characters as much. Though, again, I will state again that I enjoyed the way the characters were presented within the historical context of it. It made me think of grandpas and 1930s.
You enjoy
people.
The documentary known as Public Enemies.
I guess, but even, I enjoyed the entertainment value of seeing people presented as they probably would have been in the 1930s, right? Like not flamboyant. Like back then, you know, there was, whatever. That's my perspective, I guess, on that. So
fair enough.
Different things for different people. Do you guys want to talk, I guess, a little bit more about the digital video style that Michael Mann has made himself known for in previous movies? I know there's going to be a lot of people who are going to compare this there's actually interesting thing is that Michael Mann made this movie called Heat, and in Heat there's a very famous bank robbery sequence shot in the same digital video style. This movie is all about bank robberies, though I think this movie fails to have one entertaining bank robbery sequence in it, and that's probably one of my bigger criticisms of this. Is it felt like each bank robbery was not only boring, but it felt like they were robbing the same bank over and over.
It felt like you get all of the robbery out of the trailer.
Yeah, so...
Yeah. Okay, so speaking to the digital film, and for me, I jotted this down as sort of the handycam style that was included throughout the movie. I chatted with this briefly with my wife about this after we were driving home from the movie, and... For me, it interrupted the flow of the movie, and I think that it was captured well when we were talking about this on the way home, that it was not so much that the style itself was disruptive, it's that it was so used so sparingly. I mean, there were only a few scenes where we sort of fell into this handycam style, and the rest of the movie was in traditional Hollywood film format, that it sort of interrupted my enjoyment of the movie. And where I think that style should be used to enhance the style of a movie or enhance the experience, and I'm all for that if you can do it well. To me, the handycam here just totally interrupted my enjoyment. Scott pointed out earlier when we were in some of these handycam scenes, the lighting was really dark. I couldn't see what was going on. I often felt like in some of the scenes as well, when the handycam type, and I say handycam liberally, you know I mean the digital format,
right.
And those scenes as well, sometimes the audio seemed really bad, and I don't know if it was just the theater we were in, but it seemed they were using the mic on the camera. I was like, couldn't you just, like, mic the character?
I had that same experience at the very beginning of this film, where it felt
yes,
like...
that's what I'm talking about.
I thought there was something wrong with our theater's speakers, but But they, yeah, there was something weird. It's like the characters were muted and the center channel was, like, almost turned off. Like, they were capturing the audio from the camera and, like, he was behind glass.
That's exactly
glass,
what
so
I'm describing. Yeah. So it sounds like it's in the movie, not in the theater. So if you hear that in your theater, it's the movie, not the theater.
Interesting. Well, no, I don't.
I hated that. For me, that really took me out of the movie. It did not enhance my experience at all. And then we talked about this feeling like a documentary. To me, whenever we had these scenes, you could clearly tell when you were being filmed in this sort of digital handycam mode versus the traditional film approach. And for me, it instantly took what was a big budget, seemingly big budget, nice, well-produced movie, and made it feel like, oh, we have half a budget to make this movie. So we're going to film half the scenes in like telenovela style, where we pull out the old digital format and film it and then splice it in with the rest of the stuff that's filmed in real Hollywood style. So I don't know. It just didn't work for me. It did not enhance my enjoyment of this movie at all.
Cool. Scott, what are your thoughts on the digital format?
Well, I mean, and this isn't directly against the cameras so much as I think just what Michael Mann's trying to do with them. But out of all the films I've seen this week, and I mean, that's about five, this was easily the most poorly lit out of all of them. I think what Michael Mann tried to do is he tried to use a lot of sort of natural light in the environments. Like he would light a restaurant the way a restaurant would actually. And then he went in there with digital cameras and tried to literally make light of what he already had. And I think that led to a really muddy-looking film. I mean, if you look at other movies, you know, the characters have beautiful catchlights in their eyes. There's wonderful shadows, contrast, highlights, you know, hair lighting, those sorts of little subtle things that can make a big difference. You don't see any of that in this film. It's all sort of lit with natural window light or lights in a restaurant or something like that.
Sure.
And it's really muddy, dark, and shadowy-looking. And using the digital cameras the way he does doesn't help. I mean, they add noise, and where digital cameras really seem to sort of suffer compared to film is in the dark areas.
It really further made this feel like a History Channel movie. I mean, we talk about this feeling like a documentary. When you introduce that sort of format, it extends that feeling that you're watching just some standard documentary filmed for the History Channel instead of a real Hollywood movie.
Now, I would say going into this, I was definitely nervous about it, because watching the trailers, you definitely notice the moments that feel like they're in 30 frames per second, you know, handycam mode. And to me, it's all about the frame rate that really makes the thing noticeable. Like, I'm less likely to notice the color differences or the way the light is captured, but the frame rate really jumps out at me, and that's something that's always annoyed me about those 120 hertz televisions you see in Best Buys. But I think going into this, it didn't bother me as much as I thought it would. Like, there were definitely moments when I noticed it, but I don't feel like it ever took away from it. Like even if it had this been shot entirely in film in the 24 frames per second the entire time, or at least that feel and look and style, like, I don't really feel like it would have added anything more necessarily. Like,
But on that same note, what did the digital camera 30 frame per second thing add to the film scenes where it was added? I mean, to me,
it
was almost like, hey, I'm Michael Mann, I do this, so I better do it throughout the movie. But I didn't feel like it made sense in this movie at all.
So to be fair, I think this movie was shot entirely in digital, and I think the fact that the frame rate sort of feels like it jumps out every once in a while, and it may have been I think he was using two different cameras, but I think it's just the way that digital sort of acts in different lighting conditions that it doesn't seem right in certain lighting conditions, which is why when you get in certain areas, it feels like this handycam documentary, History Channel kind of look. But I guess to me, and I guess this is just how I sort of eased into this movie, was it again reinforced the realism that they were trying to show of that style. And to me, I think I kind of appreciated the fact that, you know, we've seen a lot of movies shot in like the 1930s or showing that 1930s style in film before, and we've seen that done up again and again. Like, I mean, if you think about like Gangs of New York, or even think about Peter Jackson's King Kong, like, we have beautiful film, beautifully lit, you know, CGI, paintbrushed movies which are shot in film of that era. And to me, I felt it was almost fresh to see this shot in a way that felt more real, I guess. It felt like this could have been a camera tagging along with these characters back in this time period. And in that...
Because a handy cam in the 30s is real as it comes.
I mean, of course it's not real, but it's about as close as you can get to coming up to the... Or at least getting into the concept that I'm watching... I'm actually watching events as they may have looked back in that time period. And to me, it really didn't grate on me as much as I thought, and I actually sort of appreciated it by the end of this film. But I think that's just, again, because it reinforced this concept that, okay, we're trying to do a realistic approach, a pseudo-documentary style way of telling the story. And to me, I guess that worked, because I wasn't looking for something more.
I guess I had different expectations, and I thought the movie could have been better without it, but I don't think it ruined the movie, but I don't think it added to the movie, and in some ways I think it did detract slightly. Not ruining, but detracted from the movie.
Well, I think it's fair to say anything that ever takes you out of the experience that you're having at a time, anything that jars you out of sort of, you know, losing yourself into a film, is a bad thing to do, no matter what it is. Because that's... Anytime you notice that you're watching a movie, that's when it's not enjoyable, right?
Well, anytime you notice the production quality, I mean, you should never be able to identify. I mean, the average moviegoer, which I consider myself squarely among the average group, we shouldn't be able to tell that production quality is changing for some reason from scene to scene. And it was pretty obvious watching this movie when it happened, and I was disappointed that was the case.
Well, I think talking about this sort of sound glitch stuff at the beginning is a very good way to talk about it, because anytime you're in a theater and you think there's something going wrong with the sound, it makes you forget that you're involved in a story, and it makes you remember that you're in a grimy theater watching a film. And
makes you remember you paid $10 for this experience.
And yeah, it makes you nervous, and it makes you annoyed. And that's anything like that you know, someone purposely puts in a movie, I think, is a mistake. And I will agree with you wholeheartedly that you should never do anything to detract from the experience of being enveloped and involved in the fiction that you're portraying. So.
Sure. So an extra question for you. What did you think of the Edgar Hoover performance in this movie? Well, obviously performing the very famous FBI role here. And I think a lot of people are looking forward to seeing how this role was played. What did you guys think of it?
I personally could not have been happier with Billy Crudup's performance. I loved his performance in Watchmen as Dr. Manhattan. I thought it was a brilliant performance of that character, and I love the fact that even though that performance was almost very, like, he played someone who was losing touch with humanity, and so it was a very almost like airy, nonchalant, don't care about what's going on way about his character. Like, this is almost like completely opposite, where it's like this very tight, scripted, very forced, and very almost showmanship personality, which is what J. Edgar Hoover was. And I absolutely loved every scene that Billy Crudup was in. Just, like, he sounded like, you know, when you hear, like, a 1930s radio announcer voice on some, you know, some old radio show. Like, that's exactly what he captured, and I thought he did a brilliant job with it. So, Scott, what'd you think?
Agreed. Something we can agree on about this film. Those were some scenes, maybe not worth the cost of admission alone, but certainly were enjoyable and something that the trailer could use more of.
Yeah, definitely. I think this is a moment where, even though he was only in the film for a couple frames, a couple moments, like, he really did stand out every time he was there. So,
yeah, I think that's universal, because I agree as well. And really, my only disappointment with this character is that he wasn't in more of the movie.
That's true.
In fact, I thought he would be in more of the movie based on my understanding of what the story was going to be. So I was a little disappointed he didn't get more screen time. But the time he had was great, and so I think he is a bright spot in this movie if you aren't a fan of some of the other things like Scott and I.
Sure. So we've talked a lot about the male characters and main roles in this film. Let's talk a little bit about the lead female role, which is played by Marion Cotillard, which is, she basically plays the wife or girlfriend or mistress of John Dillinger's character. What did you guys think of her performance in this film?
I don't think there was anything wrong with her performance as far as it was performed. I just think her character came out flat.
In what ways do you feel like it came out flat?
Well, I mean, maybe it's a combination of the editing and the writing, but, you know, I never really got a sense of who she was, what made her tick as a person, you know, what interested in the John Dillinger character in the first place. It's just like, oh, you know, he likes movies, good clothes, fast cars, and you. Well, that's, you know, it's not enough to describe personal motivation, describe the drive, you know, the human side of her. I don't think that really came out in this film. I think it was just sort of, oh, well, she's here, and now there's an FBI agent smacking her around, so you should be on her side.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree completely. I did not get emotionally attached to her character, even though I felt like I should have. And I think the movie really thought that we all had become very emotionally attached to her because the ending really hinges on that. And I won't spoil the ending yet, but you know, it all depends on you being emotionally connected to her. And I think that they just focused too much time on John Dillinger, on Johnny Depp, that we never really were given time to develop a backstory or a real attachment to his love interest here. And everything that they did to her, including that interrogation scene that Scott just referenced, it kind of fell flat. I mean, you got that you were upset, but you didn't really feel it inside like you do in some other movies. Like, again, I'll reference Up again, because Up is one of those movies where, of the movies I've seen this summer, I mean, it just it jerks at your tear strings. I mean, it really reaches deep inside and pulls at you.
Sure.
When the main character in Up, or the old guy, loses his wife, you're just like, ugh, you know. And they did that in 5 minutes. I mean, right. Pixar in 5 minutes did what this movie couldn't do in an entire 2 hours, and that is make me just like, oh, I can't believe you lost your wife, in an animated film and real people on a real screen. I did not get that same emotional connection to her. So. She did a good job playing the role, but the role was not deep enough for it to be really emotionally impactful.
Well, I'll agree that I don't feel like I became super attached to this character. And in fact, I remember distinctly one moment when Johnny Depp's character is being brought in. Like, he's been captured, and he yells out, like, what have you done with Billy? I'm like, Billy, is that another one of his henchmen or something like that? I'm like, oh, wait, that's the name of his girlfriend. That took me a little while to get to, but... No, all in all, I thought it was acceptable. I didn't think it was stellar. I think we were supposed to get across that she was sort of attracted to the wildness of this character, who basically only lived for the moment and kind of, you know, flew by the seat of his pants, which, you know, eventually ends up coming around to bite him. But I really don't feel like we did get to know
but
enough of her.
Did you get that from her performance? Like, I got from a number of scenes that she wasn't really thrilled with the way he didn't think ahead, and he didn't think about the fact that if he kept robbing banks, he was going to get captured or killed. I got the sense from a number of points that she just all around didn't seem to be too thrilled with what her love interest was doing, but yet again, we didn't ever get another side of her to suggest what she preferred he do. So,
well, to me, I got, you know, I got the sense that she was almost like, you know, a real woman who had been in that situation. Like, she was attracted to the brashness of Johnny Depp's character, although, you know, still being grounded in the fact that, you know, eventually you're going to get caught and you're going to die and this is all going to end up badly. But even though that was her practical side, she still had this attraction to the sort of wild nature, and that's what kept her with him, even after she would say, you know, I'm worried that you're eventually going to get caught and this is all going to come to a very sad end. But
true.
And I feel like I got that enough in the sort of subtleties of her facial expressions, but clearly a lot of this movie was played on subtle emotional aspects, and
you had to want to see it.
Oh, you had to you definitely you have to, I think on it. Maybe that just, and this may be because I've had the fact of a week to think on it now, and you coming very fresh off this movie, I think it's, you can see, I guess, some of the differences. Like, you can almost start to understand things in retrospect, but they don't jump out and latch onto you immediately, and that is definitely a criticism that you can throw at Michael Mann's presentation of this film.
Again, let me be very clear for anybody where this may be confusing up to this point, if you're still with us with this with this dribble. Not to say that we're not drivel.
Again, the opinions of Todd Engler.
I don't think highly of myself. I think I am just drivel. I'm one man's opinion. And if you're listening to my opinion at this point, thank you very much. I don't know why you are, but thanks. So building on my opinion, I think that, you know, again, it's one of these things with this movie where I don't think the performances were bad. I don't think the movie was bad. I mean, if we compared this to last week's Transformers, I thought this movie was a much better representation of respecting the craft of making movies and making a good story, executing that story, overall making a good movie. However, where this movie failed for me was in being entertaining. So it was well done. It addressed the ideas of a good movie making process, if that's such a thing. But if somebody came and asked me to go see Public Enemies or Transformers, I'm really at a bit of a crossroads, because if it's somebody who I know wants to see an entertaining movie, I'm probably going to recommend Transformers despite its flaws, because it's more entertaining than this movie pays off to be after 2.5 hours. So, you know, that's, again, the pain I feel is that this movie had such great potential, it just lost its entertainment quality because of some of the choices that were made.
Sure. No, I think... Good.
Go ahead.
I
change the subject.
I think that's probably true, and I think we should probably go ahead and wrap this up. Let's go ahead and do some final thoughts on this. Scott, why don't you give us your final thoughts, final recommendations for this?
C+. See it if you're a fan of Johnny Depp.
Which I imagine most people are.
Most people probably are. And I mean, if you're the sort of person who doesn't want any films of his canon of work to be left out of your viewing, you know, your viewing schedule, then go and see it. You know, don't go and see it if you're a fan of Christian Bale. He doesn't do anything in this movie. Don't go and see it if you're a fan of one of the other cast members. You know, they're just sort of there and they're not. It's the weakest sort of recommendation I can give.
And, Todd, do you want to add something on to yours?
Well, I think that surprisingly, for as much as we've chatted here, we didn't really talk much about Johnny Depp. And I'm a huge fan of Johnny Depp's. I think he's one of the best actors in Hollywood right now, especially at adapting characters. If you are a Johnny Depp fan, you won't be disappointed in his performance. You will enjoy the movie for that, if nothing else but that. It's worth seeing. But if you're looking for an entertaining experience, don't pick this movie. This is a movie to go see if you're ready to appreciate its production qualities, if you're ready to set aside the fact that some of it does feel a little long. But it's a good movie, not the most entertaining movie, but Johnny Depp fans, go see it. Anybody feel for an entertaining movie, as much as it pains me to say it, go see Transformers.
All right, and I will definitely tack on there that if you are at all a history buff, if you're the kind of person who will sit and watch modern Marvels when it comes on, I think this is definitely your film. You should see it. But beyond that, this movie is definitely strives for realism in some degree. Maybe doesn't do it as well as other films has or as other true documentaries have. But this definitely movie is all about, I think, subtlety. And in that sense, it's definitely subtly entertaining. So it's
raving
a
review.
It's a movie you could come out and say, yeah, I thought it was a good movie, but you're not going to come out and be like, oh man, this is a great movie, everyone should go see this. So see it if you were interested and kind of want to see it. Definitely see it if you're a history buff. If you're looking for action-packed, entertaining, maybe don't see Transformers. Maybe,
summer blockbuster.
Maybe wait till next week and see something else. All right, well, I think that just about does it for this episode of Weekly Monotony. Thanks again, everyone, for joining us. And as always, come back to dailymonotony.com as often as you can for the latest movie reviews, game reviews, and news about those previous two. And as always, drop us a line by sending us an email to dailymonotony@gmail.com or leaving a comment on one of our blog posts or on this Weekly Monotony blog post, if you see fit in doing it. And till next time, all that I can say is we like video games, movies, good beer, and fast processors. What else you need to know?
Until Daily Variety. Bye-bye, Blackbird. So is he. Bye.